Please turn to Isaiah chapter 6. We continue with our series in Isaiah. We're going to be looking at it morning and evening for the next 5 weeks. So please do come out in the evenings if you can. And if not, listen during the week so you can follow along on the next Lord's Day. Isaiah chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had 6 wings, with 2 he covered his face, and with 2 he covered his feet, and with 2 he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here am I. Send me." And he said, "Go and say to this people, keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy and blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn and be healed." Then I said, "How long, O Lord?" And he said, "Until cities lie waste without inhabitant, and houses without people, and the land is a desolate waste, and the Lord removes people far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land, and though a tenth remain in it, it will be burned again, like a terebinth or an oak, whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump." In the year that King Uzziah died, the opening words of this famous chapter in Isaiah strike an ominous tone. King Uzziah had reigned for 52 years over Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel. He was like our present queen. He was one of the longest reigning monarchs in the Davidic dynasty. 2 Chronicles tells us that he was a godly man who did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and the Lord blessed him. He had victories over the Philistines and other nations. He strengthened the defense of Jerusalem with towers and reinforced the city walls. He expanded Judah's agricultural prosperity. He restored Judah's military power close to what it was in David's day. Uzziah was a great king. He was a beloved king. But his life did not end well. He became proud and presumptuous, and on one occasion he entered the temple to offer incense, something only priests were allowed to do. When the priests confronted him, he began screaming at them in a rage, only to find leprosy breaking out on his scalp. For the last 10 years of his life, he lived in a separate house as a leper until his death in 740 BC. And the nation went in to mourning. And in that moment of national mourning, Isaiah went to the temple, presumably looking for consolation, because he had known this king personally. Isaiah was a prophet of nobility. He lived in the king's courts. He was like the queen's chaplain. He had been at the king's dinner table for banquets. He'd been in the king's courtroom for decisions. He'd walked the corridors of the palace. He was a man in the know, and he had known Uzziah, this great king come tragic leper. And his world was falling apart because his king was dead. The great Uzziah, the beloved Uzziah, dead. And at the same moment in history, Assyria was rising in power, crushing everyone who came in their way. This was a time of great uncertainty, great instability. It was a crisis in sovereignty. It's not dissimilar to where we find ourselves as a nation. Whatever you thought of the vote in the recent European referendum, whether you're happy or sad or indifferent, when you woke up on the morning of Friday the 24th of June, the fact is that as a country we have entered a time of uncertainty, of instability. There's a crisis in sovereignty. And after 43 years in the European Union, we are about to go it alone in the big wide world. It's the kind of instability and crisis of sovereignty that we'll experience when Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth dies, which will happen in our own lifetime. She's presently the longest serving monarch in British history, 64 years and counting. But when she dies, it will be a time of uncertainty, of instability. There will be a crisis of sovereignty. Who will be king, Charles or William? And what will they be like? But this kind of uncertainty, instability, this kind of crisis of sovereignty, it can be experienced not just nationally, but personally. Every week in our lives, we experience things that show us that we are not in control, that we are not the kings and queens of our own lives. Things happen to us that are outside of our control, which unsettle us, destabilize us. They project us into a period of uncertainty, instability. The king is dead because we're not the kings or queens of our own lives. We're not in control. And that's exactly what Isaiah experienced at a national and personal level in the year that King Uzziah died. He was no longer in control. And through that experience, Isaiah learned four things that are equally relevant for our own lives. Because what Isaiah saw in the temple is incredibly practical for our Christian service in God's kingdom, just as it was for him. Here's the first thing we need to see in moments of uncertainty, of instability, in crises of sovereignty. We need to see the King of holiness. We need to see the King's holiness. Verses 1 to 3. In the year the King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne. Now those are surprising words. Not because Uzziah died suddenly, as I said, for 10 years he was unwell in a house. So his death isn't surprising. What's surprising is who Isaiah talks about after Uzziah. We'd expect him to say, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw Jotham, Uzziah's son, sitting on the throne. In other words, the king is dead. Long live the king. It's what happens when there's a transition between kings. 1952, when King George died, the headlines in the newspapers, the king is dead, long live the queen. And one day, when Queen Elizabeth dies, the newspapers will say, the queen is dead, long live the king. It's a saying that is meant to stop uncertainty, to stave instability, to solve the crisis of sovereignty. The king is dead, long live another king. And that's what Isaiah sees. Except it's not Jotham, the king. It's the Lord who is king, seated on his throne. And that's what we need to see at this point in our nation's history, at this point in our personal lives. We need to see the Lord seated on his throne. And look what Isaiah sees when he sees him on his throne. He's on his throne reigning, but he is high and exalted. and the train of his robe fills the temple. There's a sense in which Isaiah is saying that he saw the Lord, but he is so highly exalted, so spectacularly immense, he can only describe the fringe of his robe down the other end of the temple. He couldn't get any closer. When Elizabeth II was coronated as queen in 1952, she walked into Westminster Abbey and sat down on her throne. She wore a beautiful white royal dress with a long train. But her beauty, her presence, her dress was not so immense that people couldn't get near her. There were officials standing either side of her. People came forward and coronated her. Her train was big and long, but it didn't fill Westminster Abbey. But not in God's temple. Not in the inner sanctum of this God. There is no room for a person to get close. He is so highly exalted, so spectacularly immense, that you can only describe the fringe of the train of his robe. You can only start to describe the edge of his majesty. And this is made clear by the creatures in his presence, verse 2. And above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face. With two he covered his feet. And with two he flew. Now, seraphim were fiery creatures, most probably angels. Perhaps they got their fiery appearance because they glimmer in the light of God himself. They're all wings and all voice. Six wings, which convey service. They're at God's beck and call. They stand above him, flying, waiting for his command. But you notice they only use two wings to fly. With two, they cover their face. With two, they cover their feet. The covering of the face shows that God is too awesome to behold. The covering of the feet shows that he is too awesome to approach. The seraphim are there, but they can't look. They are present, but they can't approach. And that's surprising, isn't it? Because they're unfallen heavenly beings. They don't have a taint of sin on them. And yet they can't look. They can't approach. Their conduct underscores that they are creatures in the presence of the Creator. They can't look, they can't approach, but they can sing, verse 3. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." Now, boys and girls, when you study English, as you grow up, one of the things you'll be taught is to emphasize words. And in English, we emphasize words in different ways. We put them in italics. We make them bold. We underline them. We write them in capitals. Well, in the Hebrew language, they didn't have any of those things. What they did was repetition. Twice if it was important, thrice if it was really important. And here's a superlative. The king is holy, holy, holy. Imagine it. Capital letters, bold, italicized, underlined. No other attribute of God is ever described like this in the Bible. You will never read or hear, "Love, love, love is the Lord of hosts. Just, just, just is the Lord of hosts." You will only ever hear, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." But what does that actually mean? What does holy mean? Well, it comes from the verb to set apart. And some say it means God is set apart. But in the Old Testament, a bronze basin could be set apart. It could be holy. I don't think the angels are in heaven singing, "Set apart, set apart, set apart is the Lord of hosts." You could sing that to a bronze bowl. So what are the seraphim saying? Well, when we talk about the holiness of God, we're in the realm of the otherness of God. Set apart is on its way to the definition, but it doesn't quite get it. God is other than we are. Martin Luther said, "Let God be God." And what Isaiah sees and hears is God as God. The holiness of God involves the godness of God, which is wholly other than what we are. It's why it's all the seraphim can sing. Sometimes we complain about Christians and churches who repeat the same thing over and over and over again. Well, actually, this is all the seraphim can sing. They're like reep-a-cheep in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader who sails to the end of the world. The seraphim have reached the world's end in the ocean of language, but like the train of his robe. Isaiah sees God's otherness, his godness, and that's all he hears from the angels. God is God. God is God. God is God. He sees it in two ways. First, he sees God's majestic holiness. The king is on the throne, high and lifted up. He is unbeholdable, unapproachable, totally different, totally distinct, wholly other, awesome in his majesty. He's transcendent, above all things, distinct from all things. That's the first way Isaiah sees God's otherness, his majestic holiness. But there's also his moral holiness, his moral purity. If you glance down to verse 5, in God's presence, Isaiah feels sinful, which means God is the complete opposite of that. He is pure. He is righteous in all things and therefore distinct from all people. So those are the two ways that Isaiah sees God's otherness, holiness, his majesty and his purity, his transcendence and his righteousness. And the seraphim make this clear, that God's majestic and moral holiness is not just restricted to the temple. Do you see that in verse 3? The whole earth is full of his glory. This is no domestic deity, no regional regis, no local lord. He is the king of holiness over the whole world. Because all the world is full of his transcendent majesty, his moral purity. King Louis XIV of France was one of the most famous kings in France. He was called the Sun King. He was so narcissistic that at his death he planned that in Notre Dame Cathedral there would only be a single light that lit the whole cathedral at his funeral. A candle burning at the front of his casket. Even in his death, he wanted everyone to be focused on him as the great king. As the court preacher Massillon rose to give the funeral oration, he walked to the front of the casket, blew out the candle. And out of the darkness of that cathedral, the people heard these words, "Only God is great. Only God is great." And that is what Isaiah hears and sees when his king is dead. It's what we need to see when the king and queen of our lives is dead. When our time in the European Union is over, when the queen dies, when we have a new prime minister, when our worlds start to fall apart, we need to see the Lord on his throne. We need to hear the angels singing. Can you hear them? Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. But there's something else we need. We need to see the king's holiness. And second, we need to feel our own sinfulness. We need to see the king's holiness, and then we need to feel our own sinfulness. Because when you're confronted with God, you never come away unchanged. Not even the temple does, verse 4. And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called. That's the seraphim calling one to another. And the house was filled with smoke. Inert, inanimate bricks shaking at a song of the seraphim. And to the sight and the sound is added the smell. So this is probably the smoke from the incense altar arising. Smoke was meant to convey that the naked human eye could not look upon God. Though the eye of sinful man, your glory may not see. We're back to the edge of the king's robe. Isaiah sees the Lord, and he doesn't actually see him. The Lord and the fringe of his robe. The Lord and the smoke is rising. And what becomes blindingly obvious to Isaiah here is that he can't approach. If the thresholds of a temple are shaking, you're not about to walk into the temple. You're not about to go further inside into the inner sanctum. He can't sing because he is a man of unclean lips. The seraphim can't look, they can't approach, but they can sing. Isaiah, he can't look, can't approach, and he can't sing. He's drawn to the sight of God on his throne. He loves the singing of the seraphim, and now he is repelled by it. Verse 5. Woe is me, for I am lost. Well, that's one of the words that's been lost in the English language, isn't it? Woe. Whoever says woe anymore? Well, someone who's in the presence of a thrice holy God. That's who. Because the word is tied to the curses of the Old Testament. It's like the opposite of blessed. Isaiah realizes he's cursed. He's doomed. He's lost. The word lost here comes from the verb to be silent. He can't sing, but it's more than just being lost for words. Because lips reveal hearts. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. James says the tongue corrupts the whole person. The lostness that Isaiah feels here is not a compartment of his life, his lips. It's the whole of his life. He feels lost to the very core of his being. He comes apart at the seams, what secular psychologists would call disintegration. Here is a man who had it all together, now he's in pieces. Boys and girls, you know the rhyme, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. And Isaiah felt like Humpty Dumpty. He had fallen to pieces in the presence of God. He'd lost his integrity. Here is a prophet who was supposed to rebuke the nation for their sinfulness. And now he realizes he's got nothing to say because he's sinful. But notice what it is that makes him see his sinfulness. Verse 5. For my eyes have seen the King. Wasn't because he saw his sin. That's not why Isaiah felt he couldn't speak. It's because he saw God. He only saw his sin because he saw God. There's a lot of people in life who see their sin and feel a wee bit guilty, but they never change. Why? Because they never see their sin in the light of the King. And the point is that Isaiah did not just intellectually admit he was a sinner. He experientially crumbled as a sinner. Too much of modern evangelicalism has lost this experiential aspect. If we want to come to God, we're told you just need to acknowledge or admit you're a sinner. And that's true. But it goes deeper than that. You need to feel your sin. You need to feel shame. For it should affect your psychological disposition. It did for Isaiah. And that's what we need in moments of uncertainty, in moments of instability, in the crises of sovereignty, national or personal. We need to see the King of Holiness, and having seen him, we need to feel our own sinfulness. We need to come to the end of ourselves. But the good news is that God doesn't leave us there. like Humpty Dumpty on the ground in pieces. Do you remember last week I said that Isaiah is the Romans of the Old Testament? It's the gospel in the Old Testament. Well, verses 6 and 7 show us exactly that. We need, third, to experience God's restoration. We need to experience God's restoration, verse 6 and 7. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." Notice how passive Isaiah is in these verses. He doesn't ask for help. He's lost for words. God sees he needs help and sends a seraphim. God isn't mentioned in these verses. But he doesn't need to be, because seraphim don't act on their own. Remember? They're creatures. They cover their feet. They cover their face. These winged angels hover above God just waiting for a command. And when they fly because they've been commanded to fly. And this seraphim is sent to restore Isaiah by God. Notice he flies to the altar and takes the coal, not with his hands, which is slightly strange because he's a fiery creature. Do you think he could handle a bit of fire? No, he has to handle it with tongs. What he's about to handle is too holy, too hot. Angels can't handle atonement things. They can only apply from a distance. They can only peer in with interest. And the angel applies the atoning work to the very place where Isaiah felt his sin most. His lips. It's one of the most sensitive parts of our body. You're eating your food, you bite your tongue, or you bite your lip. It's sore. Imagine putting a burning coal from your winter fire on your lip. It would hurt. But in Isaiah's case, it was necessary. He needed his sin taken away, his guilt taken away, because he was God's spokesperson. He was a prophet. He was God's mouthpiece. And if he was going to serve in God's kingdom, then he needed to be cleansed at the very point of his service, his mouth, his lips. He might have felt like Humpty Dumpty on the ground in pieces, but here is God starting to put him back together again. God gave him his voice back. But notice how it comes about. By a king on a throne, high and lifted up, providing atonement from an altar of sacrifice. Later in Isaiah, we read of Judah's king, the suffering servant, being high and lifted up, and providing atonement by the sacrifice of himself. So in Isaiah 6, we have a king in heaven, high and lifted up, providing atonement from an altar of sacrifice. In Isaiah 53, we have a king on earth who is high and lifted up, providing atonement by the sacrifice of himself. And in Jesus Christ, we find the fulfillment of both. He is the Lord of heaven, high and lifted up, seated on his throne, who leaves his throne to provide atonement. He is the suffering servant on earth, on a cross, high and lifted up. And through the sacrifice of his death, he provides atonement. It's why in John's gospel, John says that Isaiah saw Christ's glory and spoke of him. Because Jesus fulfills Isaiah 6. And Isaiah 53. And in so doing, he shows us the holiness of God. A holiness which exposes our sins, but notice what else it does. It atones for our sins. God's holiness atones for our sins. We tend to think of God's holiness just connected to his righteousness, his justice, exposing sin, punishing sin. That is true. But God's holiness just as equally atones for sin, because he is holy love, holy gracious, holy merciful. The cross is the altar of sacrifice where God reveals his holiness to us. Justice, and mercy kiss. And God brings his forgiving touch to the very place in our lives that we need it. And in receiving that touch, he prepares us for service, which brings us to the final point. If we've seen the King of Holiness, if we've felt our own sinfulness, if we've experienced God's restoration, then fourth, we need to give ourselves to God's mission. We need to give ourselves to God's mission. Verses 8 to 13. The first half of the chapter is Isaiah's vision of God. The second half is God's commission of Isaiah. But it's probably the most anticlimactic commissioning service you could ever attend. Even though God speaks for the first time, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" Look at how anticlimactic this is. Isaiah, first of all, says, "I'll go." God says, "Great." And then he says to him, "Go and say to this people, keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy and blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, lest they hear with their ears, lest they understand with their hearts and turn and be healed." What is that all about? Some people try to soften these verses, but I don't think we can get around them. Isaiah's ministry was a ministry of hardening God's people to bring them to judgment. Isaiah is puzzled by it. Verse 11, "How long, O Lord? Surely there's an end point here." And God says, "You are to preach this until the cities lie waste, without inhabitant, houses without people, land desolately waste. The Lord removes people far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land." How long, Isaiah? Until the whole thing's completely wiped out. That's how long. "I want you to preach until inevitable judgment falls." This, of course, was when Assyria started to invade, and eventually Babylon would come in and crush Judah and Jerusalem and take people into exile. And God wants Isaiah to preach so that judgment will fall. It's the same way Jesus is preaching, because he quotes these verses in Mark chapter 4 when he speaks about his parables. He says he tells parables in order to blind, to deafen, to harden. His preaching hardened hearts, but not as an end in itself, rather as a means to salvation. Because think about what Jesus' parables did. They hardened the hearts of the people. They hardened the religious leaders. And what did they do as a result? They crucified him. The inevitable judgment. But what came out of that inevitable judgment? Salvation. Salvation through judgment. And that was the same with Isaiah's ministry. His message was one of judgment, salvation. Remember the two-beat rhythm of Isaiah? Judgment, salvation. Judgment, salvation. And that's the note that Isaiah ends on in verse 13. "And though a tenth remain in it, it will be burned again, like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains when it is felled." The holy seed is its stump. Now, when we cut a tree down, if you imagine one of those trees out there being cut down, the stump's left, we just think dead. And that's true. It looks dead. When I was in Australia, I worked for 6 months on a maintenance team at the college I'd studied at. And part of my task was cutting down trees and destroying stumps. And I learned a whole lot about trees and stumps. I thought you just cut the tree down and just that's it. But we would cut the tree down. We would poison the stump. And then 3 weeks later, we'd come when the poison had worked its way in. And we'd take a machine and we would cut up that stump right into the ground. Why? Because if you leave a stump, inevitably another tree will grow. And look what God leaves after the judgment on Judah. A stump. The holy seed is its stump. The remnant, the survivors. And as we'll see tonight in Isaiah 11, what starts to come from a stump? A little shoot, which will grow into a tree and transform the world. The last word of the gospel is not judgment, but salvation. The gospel story is how God saves his people through judgment for the transformation of the world, which means being part of God's mission is well worth our time and commitment, because God is saving a people through judgment for the transformation of the world. For each of us here this morning, our involvement in that proclamation of the gospel will be different. Some of us will go, like the Kinsellas and Glovers. Others of us will stay and pray and give and serve and step up into ministries in this church. But we're all involved in God's mission. Because if we've seen the King of Holiness, if we've felt our own sinfulness and experienced his restoration, then how else should we spend our lives?